Blog Talk Radio.
This is the LA Steel Show.
It just started.
I'm Lila.
Good evening.
And you're?
Leo. Yeah.
So,
you started before it started. But
anyway.
Yeah, so anyway, we're here tonight. And I'm having a birthday tonight. And I was about to cancel this show last week. And I decided I would go with it.
Even though it's your birthday.
Yeah, it's my birthday.
He's a trooper, folks.
Yeah.
Even though it's his birthday.
What it was, I forgot to cancel it. And before I knew it, I had to do it.
And your birthday snuck up on you.
Yeah, so. We're here tonight. And we got great.
I have a good interview, actually, with Brad Friedman, The Velvet Revolution.
Yeah.
And he's justice@justice.com. Is that how?
Restore justice at justice.com. Yeah.
Is that what it is? Restore justice at justice.com. That's his site, Velvet Revolution also. And Brad is very interested in restoring justice to people who were persecuted politically for their political views by the last administration's Justice Department. And so he's making that his mission and trying to get all of us involved, and I think he's absolutely right to do this. And he's a great guy. He's been involved in a lot of movements to restore integrity and honesty, including
the voting system,
and what else? He's been involved in a lot of things. But,
yeah,
Keeps us up to date on all kinds of things. He's an investigative journalist. He's really excellent. And I really felt proud to have him on the show because he is such a good guy. So that interview is coming up, and he tries to keep us up to date on things, and I think it's really important that we get the message out there.
Yeah.
So that'll be on in about a half hour, and that's about a half hour interview, and that was really good. And I hope all you guys that are listening are looking up to notice whether the sky is being sprayed by aerosols. They're called chemtrails. And you should look up and make sure that you become your own investigative journalist. You should look that up on the Internet. And you can find it at different sites like, what's it, Chemtrails 9? What are some of those sites, Leo?
Oh, you can go to variumblues.com, Chemtrails 911.
Yeah. Or put chemtrails.
Carnicom.com, New York Skywatch, Arizona Skywatch.
And find out some. If you don't
California
know any,
Skywatch.
Yeah, if you don't know anything about it, find out.
Yeah.
And you'll be surprised what's happening to all of us.
I think you will be. But.
In the meantime, we have a little news to read.
Yeah, I kind of like this one. I got a kick out of this one. It's a little.
Waterboard Arabs for Jesus.
Yeah, waterboard an Arab for Jesus. And this is by LouRockwell.com.
If you would read this one with the small print, I'll trade with you.
Okay, that's another one. Falling Wage Syndrome.
That's a good one.
I'm reluctant to, this is by Paul Krugman, and I'm always reluctant to read anything from
really?
The New York Times or
well,
the New York Times.
Well, there's some good things, though.
But Krugman, you know, he's an anti-Bushite, he won the Nobel Prize for Economics. But you know, anything in the New York Times, I'm always reluctant to read.
You're a little
read.
Suspect of
Yeah, them. But I'll do this one. It's called Falling Wage Syndrome. Wages are falling all across America. Some of the wage cuts, like the givebacks of Chrysler workers, are the price of federal aid. Others, like the tentative agreement on a salary cut here at the Times, are the result of discussions between employers and their union employees. Still others reflect the brute fact of a weak labor market. Workers don't dare protest when their wages aren't cut, or when their wages are cut, because they don't think they can find other jobs.
Yeah.
Whatever the specifics, however, falling wages are a symptom of a sick economy, and they're a symptom that can make the economy even sicker. First things first, anecdotes often falling wages are proliferating, but how broad is the phenomenon? The answer is very. It is true that many workers are still getting paid increases, but there are enough pay cuts out there that, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the average cost of employing workers in the private sector rose only 0.2% in the first quarter of this year, the lowest increase on record. And since the job market is still getting worse, it wouldn't be at all surprising if overall wages started falling later this year. But why is that a bad thing? After all, many workers are accepting pay cuts in order to save jobs. That's wrong. What's wrong with that? The answer lies in one of those paradoxes that plague our economy right now. We're suffering from the paradox of thrift. Saving is a virtue, but when everyone tries to sharply increase savings at the same time, the effect is a depressed economy. We're suffering from the paradox of deleveraging. Reducing debt and cleaning up balance sheets is good, but when everyone tries to sell off assets and pay down debt at the same time, the result is a financial crisis. And soon we may be facing the paradox of wages. Workers at any one company can help save their jobs by accepting lower wages. But when employers across the economy, cut wages at the same time, the result is higher unemployment. Here's how the paradox works. Suppose that workers at the XYZ Corporation accept the pay cut. That lets XYZ management cut prices, making its products more competitive. Sales rise, and more workers can keep their jobs. So you might think that wage cuts raise employment, which they do at the level of the individual employer. But if everyone takes a pay cut, nobody gains a competitive advantage. So there's no benefit to the economy from lower wages. Meanwhile, the fall in wages can worsen the economy's problem on other fronts. In particular, falling wages and hence falling incomes worsen the problem of excess debt. Your monthly mortgage payments don't go down with your paycheck. America came into this crisis with household debt as a percentage of income at its highest level since the 1930s. And families are trying to work that debt down by saving more than they have in a decade. But as wages fall, they're chasing a moving target, and the rising burden of debt will put downward pressure on consumer spending, keeping the economy depressed. Things get even worse if businesses and consumers expect wages to fall further in the future. John Maynard Keynes put it clearly more than 70 years ago, the effect of an expectation that wages are going to sag by, say, 2% in the coming year, will be roughly equivalent to the effect of a rise of 2% in the amount of interest payable for the same period. And a rise in the effective interest rate is the last thing this economy needs. So, concern about falling wages isn't just theory. Japan, where private sector wages fell an average of more than 1% a year from 1997 to 2003, is an object lesson in how wage deflation can contribute to economic stagnation. So what should we conclude about the growing evidence of sagging wages in America? Mainly that stabilizing the economy isn't enough. We need a real recovery. There has been a lot of talk lately about green shoots and all that, and there are indeed indications that the economic plunge that began last fall may be leveling off. But the National Bureau of Economic Research might even declare the recession over later this year. But the unemployment rate is almost certainly still rising, and all signs point to a terrible job market for many months, if not years to come, which is a recipe for continuing wage cuts, which will in turn keep the economy weak. To break that vicious cycle, we basically need more stimulus, more decisive action on the banks, and more job creation. Credit where credit is due. President Obama and his economic advisors seem to have steered the economy away from the abyss, but the risk that America will turn into Japan, that will face years of deflation and stagnation, seems, if anything, to be rising. So it's not a good thing. And if you're out there and you just took a wage cut, probably not the best thing that you could do.
For you either, yeah. No.
Or for the economy. but people don't realize this.
Your costs are the same. I don't see much going down. And cost of food hasn't gone down much.
Just that dairy went down a little bit when we went shopping.
Yeah,
it's putting dairy farmers out of business, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, it's just not, you know, just raise the prices, raise the wages, and things will work out. But if you start depressing the wages and depressing everything, then people can't afford to live. And because the inflation is still there, even though deflation, not deflation, but wage deflation, okay, or wage decline isn't helping. So I'm reminded of Alan Greenspan quoting Alan Greenspan in some interview he gave, or actually he was giving a speech in front of, I think it was the CFR, which was gonna, you know, another bunch of traders. And people who wanted to see this, what's happening now, happen, to equalize the global economy, which was depress it and throw it into a complete depression, right? And he said that the only way that a global economy could exist any equality in the economy can exist globally is if the Americans' wages are severely decreased, okay? And he said this, and, you know, I never forgot it because he's a prick.
He was the son of a bitch
that got us into this, all right? And
don't listen to his wife's interviews because she's just a globalist.
For those of you who want to know who his wife is, it's Andrea Mitchell of NBC, right? They're a huge, huge globalist group. And nothing they talk about that you can believe, all right? It's either a distraction or out and out lies. So, you know, let's forget about it. Forget about these groups and forget about these people because this is who they are. And everybody's sitting in the mainstream media right now are nothing but liars and detractors and globalists and people who are trying to destroy their freaking country, all right, not rebuild it. And it's a sick, sick thing. And if you don't believe me, just do some research on your own. I mean, we've talked about this for 6 years on the radio. We brought up all kinds of people and all kinds of experts.
Well, other people are working hard at this.
Other people absolutely.
All of
but
our guests.
Still, you know, but people still believe these bastards, and you know, and
not everybody though. People are beginning to be turned around.
They're waking up, but still,
and that's good.
It's a frightening situation.
But anyway, LouRockwell.com,
yeah.
Waterboard, and Arab for Jesus. In a recent column, Eric Margolis labeled the Republicans as America's champions of war and torture. Those are some harsh words. Harsh but true. The recent release of the Bush torture memos and the revelation that the CIA waterboarded Abu Zubaydah 83 times and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed 183 times before Bush claimed that we don't torture has elicited a predictable response from conservative Christians who think the Republican Party is the party of God. Silence. It is also no surprise that a new survey by the Pew Research Center for the People in the Press shows that of four major religious traditions in the United States, white evangelical Protestant, white non-Hispanic Catholic, white mainline Protestant, and unaffiliated, white evangelical Protestants are more likely to believe that the use of torture against suspected terrorists can often or sometimes be justified. In fact, the more often people attended church, the more likely they were to justify torture. A similar poll commissioned last year by Faith in Public Life and Mercy University reported that almost 60% of Southern evangelicals believe that torture was often or sometimes justified. When the Spanish did it, it was torture. When the Japanese did it, it was torture. When the Germans did it, it was torture. When the Khmer Rouge did it, it was torture. When waterboarding was done by Americans under the Republican administration, it suddenly became an enhanced interrogation technique. Such has not always been the case. Waterboarding-like techniques used by American soldiers during the Philippine insurrection and the Vietnamese War were condemned, but that was before the War on Terror, where anything goes in the name of national security. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was not waterboarded 183 times, says a Republican hack at Fox News. The number is highly misleading in a vast inflation, because the much-cited figure represents the number of times water was poured in Mohammed's face, not the number of times the CIA applied simulated drowning techniques on the terrorist suspect.
But not only that, it was stated that they did that in 1 month's time.
Isn't that awful?
163 waterboarding.
183.
83 in 1 month. I mean, it's absolute sickness.
So, okay, so how many pours does it take to be waterboarded? If a prisoner is removed from a cell, taken into an interrogation room, forced to endure one pour, then taken back to a cell, can we not say he was waterboarded because he only suffered one pour? And what about Abu Zubaydah? In addition to being waterboarded, he had a collar wrapped around his neck, was smashed against the wall, was forced to stay in a pitch-dark box for hours, was stripped naked, was suspended from hooks in the ceiling, and was deprived of sleep. Is it not torture if these things happen only one time?
Well, it happened in the Grand Inquisition.
Yeah.
You know, and the only thing they didn't do here was brand people.
Or put them on the rack.
Or put them on the rack. They probably did that. They just don't talk about it.
The strict constitutionalist at Fox, Judge Andrew Napolitano, who actually read the 175 pages of torture memos, sees things differently from the defenders of the Bush regime and his network. This is not rocket science and it is not an art. Everyone knows torture when they see it, and no amount of twisted logic can detract from its illegal horror, its moral antipathy, and its attack at the core American values. Who are these CIA operatives that engage in waterboarding and other forms of torture? What kind of man does such a thing? The FBI does profiles of serial killers. How about a profile of a CIA agent who tortures prisoners in the interest of national security, of course?
I guarantee there's sadomasochists. Yeah.
Are these men Christians? I suppose they are. The majority of Americans claim to be a Christian of some sort.
Just sadomasochists.
Yeah, can a Christian waterboard an Arab for Jesus? For the Christian, there is no other way to do it. The Bible says, and whatever ye do in word or deed, do all the same in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God and the Father by him. Colossians 3:17. It also says that whatsoever we do, we should do it heartily as to the Lord. Colossians 3:23. We should do everything to the glory of God. Corinthians 10:31. Can a Christian smash someone against a wall in the name of the Lord Jesus? Can a Christian heartily lock someone in a dark box for hours at a time? Can a Christian deprive someone of sleep to the glory of God? Can a Christian give thanks to God while he hangs someone from the ceiling? Sure he can, but not without violating the whole tenor of the New Testament.
But under the Old Testament, the Jews were allowed to go in and massacre the Canaanites and massacre
That's why we were given the New Testament.
Yeah.
Christians are told to put up anger, wrath, and malice. Colossians, is that how you pronounce
Colossians.
It? Colossians 3:8. To not render evil for evil. Thessalonians 5:15. And to not give offense. 1 Corinthians 10:30. To abstain from all appearance of evil. Colossians 5:22. And to not be a brawler. Titus 3:2. And to abhor that which is evil. Romans 12:9. I think this rules out waterboarding. Okay, but suppose the perpetrators of torture in the CIA do not claim to be Christians, the Testament says. Well, does that mean it's okay if Christians cheer them on? If not, then what should Christians do? Should they just be different? John the Baptist told Herod, "It is not lawful for thee to have her," when he married his brother's wife. Excuse me. He also told Roman soldiers, do violence to no man. And why aren't Christians doing likewise? Why aren't Christians letting the CIA and the military know that waterboarding is torture and torture is wrong? Could it be that these institutions are filled with Christians? Could it be that Christians respect these institutions? Could it be that Christians trust these institutions? I think all of the above are true.
Could it be that Christians advocate torture, murder, genocide, war?
Where is the outrage from the evangelical community over these torture memos? I'll tell you where it is. It's in the same place as the outrage over the invasion of Iraq, the thousands upon thousands of dead Iraqis, the over 4,000 American soldiers who died for a lie, the bloodbath that Iraq has become, the Guantanamo prison camp, the CIA secret prisons, the destruction of liberty in America due to the war on terror, and America's evil foreign policy. Christians should be leaving the Republican Party in droves. Christians should be crawling on broken glass as penance for blindly supporting the Republican Party. Christians should be repenting in sackcloth and ashes for thinking the Republican Party was the party of God. There is no party of God. In my opinion.
No, of course not.
Because it's made political parties are made up of men. Instead, even as more and more crimes of the Bush administration come to light, I fear that Christians who are outraged, and rightly so, at the crimes of the Obama administration, and the Democrats will look in the next election to the Republicans as their savior instead of the champions of war and torture. America needs more Christians like John the Baptist instead of John Hagee. I don't know him.
Hagee is a huge minister.
Was that the fellow who spoke at Obama's inauguration?
No. He's the biggest hypocritical evangelist that ever lived. All right.
I don't know which one he is.
I mean, he's got hundreds of thousands of followers, and he's nothing more than a big cult. Minister, and he advocates he's big friends with the Jews, even though he advocates the death of the Jews through the apocalypse. Hagee is insane. Okay, and he's been proven. No, he's insane. All right, and most of these evangelical preachers are insane. Okay, they make absolutely no sense, and they're advocating war. They're advocating, the war against Islam. They're advocating all kinds of shit, and they're just total insane people, all right? But obviously they attract the other insane people in the country, which are all fundamentalists, all right? So it's like, it's a frightening, absolute frightening, mind-boggling, mind-washing
how people can think that that's okay.
I don't know, people do, and why they do, I have no idea, because they're sadists, basically, they're sadistic.
They must be missing something in their makeup.
No, they're sadistic, they love the idea of hurting somebody, killing somebody, war. Bloodshed, bloodlust. Americans have a great bloodlust,
Let's put some Americans.
I'm saying a lot of Americans.
I think some Americans. And unfortunately, the ones in power seem to be that way.
Look, I mean, 60% of the Americans still supported the Iraq war, even Bush, okay? Mm-hmm. It's sick.
How are we doing for our interview?
And they support Obama's bullshit, okay, with Pakistan and Afghanistan
Iraq
and everything else. I mean,
he's expanded the war, which I find very disappointing.
It's like we got nothing here with Obama. We got nothing with these guys. They're just lying faces of death and destruction, and you're never going to get away from this unless you get away from it. Totally get away from it.
So do we have our interview?
Is it that time?
Yeah, just about. Do you need to get
24.
That off?
See if there's anything else I can tell you. There was one more thing, a quick article here. America sold out for $5.2 billion. The article as follows is my recent piece on American Financial Oligarchy, which is a synopsis of... hang on a second. I was going to read this, but it's just another talking head talking above her head. All right. And most people can't read the article because it doesn't make any sense. I thought it did, but as I read it again, it didn't make any sense.
Well, it's long and kind of convoluted.
Yeah, so I'll pass on it. Now, sometimes I even get stuck with talking heads that don't make sense. Anyway, let's see if we get one more here. One more. On this interview, she reads
an explanation
about
a little bit about Brad Friedman
and what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to get to that right now. So
I hope you find it informative and you go to the sites that
he tells
you about and find out more information for yourself.
Okay, here we go.
Coalition of organizations and individuals dedicated to an honest and accountable government launched Restore Justice at Justice, www.restorejusticeatjustice.com, a campaign to clean up the Department of Justice's sad record of political prosecutions under the Bush administration. These organizations, representing hundreds of thousands of members, have a strong track record of spurring actions on critical issues. The coalition has sent a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder, available at Restore Justice at Justice website, requesting that he quickly investigate and identify those targeted and vacated their convictions, beginning with Alabama ex-governor Don Siegelman and attorney Paul Miner. The coalition asserts under the Justice Department, under the Bush administration, the Justice Department was driven by ideology, and prosecutions were often used to settle scores and intimidate the opposition. The GOP, at the direction of Karl Rove, used the Department of Justice to target political enemies, including Democratic contributors and those who were a threat to the GOP electoral gains and big business interests. The department was used as an arm of the White House to destroy those Democrats. This political profiling resulted in the criminal prosecution of many on the GOP list, including Don Siegelman and Paul Miner. Last week, Attorney General Holder ordered the dismissal of charges against Senator Ted Stevens because of prosecutorial misconduct. In coalition spokesperson Brad Feeman, the renowned crusader for electoral reform states, because targeted political prosecutions also constitute prosecutorial misconduct, AG Holder should also apply the same standard to Siegelman, Miner, and all the other identified by the Bush Department of Justice, said Friedman. Siegelman and Miner were targeted were targets of political profiling, which is as unjust as racial profiling. President Obama and Attorney General Holder promised to return justice to the Justice Department and free the department from politics. We demand that they do so. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., one of the signers at RestoreJusticeAtJustice.com, has stated publicly that Paul Miner is an innocent man who was targeted by Karl Rove, prosecuted by crooked Justice Department prosecutors, and sentenced to a breathtaking 11-year sentence for nonviolent white-collar crimes he didn't commit, while Miner's wife of 41 years lies in a hospital dying from cancer, unable to utter the word love to her husband. Kennedy surmises the case this way. Karl Rove's crooked henchmen at the U.S. Justice Department have turned this dignified gentleman's life into a horrible ordeal that is a disgrace to America and democracy. Late Monday, Sylvia Miner died without her husband by her side after the Department of Justice opposed Miner's bail, pending appeal, and a compassionate furlough. The campaign is spearheaded by Velvet Revolution, a national nonprofit affiliate with over 150 organizations. The coalition urges other organizations that care about justice to sign on to this campaign by sending an email to restorejustice@justice@thevelvetrevolution.us. Individuals can sign on at www.restorejustice@justice.com. And I have a little bit here information about the Siegelman case. And let's see what I can read to you about that. Attorney General Eric Holder's recent decision to drop all the charges against Ted Stevens, the reformer Senate, Republican senator from Alaska, because of prosecutorial misconduct, raises an important question. What about Don Siegelman? A bipartisan group of 75 former state attorney generals has written to Mr. Holder asking him to take a fresh look at the former Alabama governor's case. He should do so right away. Mr. Siegelman was convicted in 2006 on dubious corruption charges. He spent 9 months in prison before being released on appeal. And I think we have Brad Friedman with us. Welcome to the show, Brad.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me again, guys.
Oh, well, we're always glad to have you. And we understand that you're hot on the tail of justice yet again. And
To restore justice.
And you've got quite a project ahead of you there. And
you're right. No small feat, restoring justice at justice. But, thanks for putting it out. Folks can, of course, get more information at restorejusticeatjustice.com. But it's a new campaign based on a letter I sent to Attorney General Eric Holder a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
A, thanking him for doing the right thing with the Republican Senator Ted Stevens and the prosecution there, which was, had improprieties within the prosecution itself. He dropped those charges against Republican Senator Ted Stevens. I think it was appropriate that he did so. However, there is a list beginning and likely not ending with folks like Governor Don Siegelman of Alabama, Paul Miner of Mississippi, Democrats who have been targeted for political prosecution over the last 8 years by the Bush Justice Department. And attention needs to be given to those prosecutions as well as an investigation for any others that occurred over the last 8 years that may have been politically targeted. We know that the Bush Justice Department targeted Democrats, and if in fact folks were prosecuted simply for the crime of being a Democrat, we need to know about that, and those prosecutions, frankly, need to be vacated.
So did you get a response from the Attorney General?
We have yet to get a response. We're asking people to stop by restorejusticeatjustice.com and sign on to that letter to continue the noise to Eric Holder demanding such an investigation. So far, I think we're up to about 900 individuals and organizations, including folks like Bobby Kennedy Jr., who have signed on, whose father, as you know, was one time the Attorney General.
Mm-hmm.
And
God bless you.
And we have asked for for people to join that campaign to make the noise that needs to be made. Look, we know that these folks in D.C. don't do anything unless someone makes them do it and raises enough hell until they have no choice but to do it. And when we launched this campaign a week or two ago, it was just prior to the release of the latest round of torture memos. And I know that that's sort of sucked a lot of the justice oxygen out of the media and out of the blogosphere, but it's equally as important as it is to bring accountability for what appear to be war crimes. We also have to remember the folks, the domestic folks, if you will, who were inappropriately prosecuted, and the Justice Department has to look at those issues, has to bring accountability, and has to set things right. So, yeah, there is quite a mess on Eric Holder's plate, no doubt.
Mm.
But, you know, when you got folks sitting in jail improperly, I think that deserves some serious attention.
Well, where
can you?
The,
oh, go ahead.
Where would the where will the investigation begin? Where will the where is the pressure right now for them to start indicting Rove and Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and all of these other demons of democracy? You know what I mean? Well, where are these guys? Well, what's happening there? Why is the pressure on a couple of and you know what bothers me too, the injustice that happened to guys like Ramos and Campion, okay, these two Border Patrol agents. You know, there was no liberal movement to help these guys. It was all the conservative movements that tried to get them, and Bush commuted their sentence instead of pardoning them, for crying out loud.
Well, look, when you begin an investigation of the sort that, you know, we're calling for in the Restore Justice at Justice campaign, or an investigation into the torture, the torture memos, potentially the impeachment of Jay Bybee, one of the Justice Department attorneys who wrote some of those torture memos, who now serves as a federal district court. I think once you begin proceedings, be they investigations or impeachment, I suspect all of these things are going to sort of work their way up the food chain very quickly, so that we realize, you know, in all of these cases, it's not a matter of, as Rumsfeld despicably described it, you know, when the Abu Ghraib business came out, it's not a matter of a few bad apples. No, it's the tree. It's the folks at the top who gave these orders. And so, as with any legal investigation, you know, you start with the low level the drug users, and it goes up to the low level dealers, and then their suppliers above them, and that's
the
when
Bush family
work its
yeah.
way up to
yeah, right.
Rove, Bush, Rumsfeld,
yeah.
Cheney, all of these guys who I believe are quite directly culpable in so many of the things that we've been talking about. But you can't get there until you start the investigations. And I was amazed to hear a couple of weeks ago when someone asked Holder directly about Don Siegelman, the former governor of Alabama, and whether an investigation had begun into that matter. Look, this guy, his story has been covered, you know, on 60 Minutes, in the New York Times, everywhere else, and yet Eric Holder said, no, we don't currently have an investigation into that. And I was just stunned. Now, this is a guy who is well-known, who's had his story told in all of these places. Imagine all of the other folks who have been targeted that we may not even know about, that are sitting in a jail somewhere rotting or facing you know, charges, lawyering up, trying to fight the politically motivated prosecutions. There is a lot of work to be done here. None of it's going to happen overnight. I know that, you know, there's a lot of folks out there who would love to throw some of the names you mentioned straight into jail, but that's not going to happen overnight. But it does need to start somewhere, and I'd say, right about now is a real good time to get started.
Brad, would you, do you have any idea or an estimate of how many victims of this political targeting there are out there?
No, you know, I really don't, and that's why we're asking him for this investigation. A recent Syracuse University study found that there were something like the numbers of Democrats to Republicans who were targeted in DOJ investigations is something like 4-1. I mean, it was just insanely out of proportion. So there's no way of knowing, really, until the folks who have access to all of this stuff and how these prosecutions came about, until they look at those things, there's no way to know how many folks we're actually talking about here. I would simply be speculating, and, you know, that's why we're asking for an investigation. You know, from those folks who have access to the documents and the information they would need to make that determination.
Whatever happened to Waxman's, Congressman Waxman's many, many supposedly investigations that he was about to start? And we never heard any more of it after Bush left the office. And I'm sure there's still a lot of files on his desk.
Well, to be frank, we never heard any more from him even before Bush left office in many cases. And I would point you to, if you've yet to see it, Sybil Edmonds, who I suspect you both know, whistleblower, the FBI, a former FBI translator, whistleblower, who was hired after 9/11 to be a translator for the FBI. She has made a number of startling allegations over the years, even though she had been gag ordered by the state secrets privilege for the Bush administration. That state secrets order is still in place. She is still unable to talk about all that she knows. However, she did contribute a guest editorial yesterday at bradblog.com, which may directly answer your question a little bit, at least, about Waxman, because, you know, Waxman was one of the folks who had promised her personally that they would be picking up her investigation into her allegations as soon as the Democrats got the majority in 2006. And sure enough, once the Democrats got into the majority, well, she was contacted by the office to say, well, we're not going to be hearing your case after all. Now, she talks about some of the reasons why and suggests that a lot of these folks may well be blackmailed, frankly, by the executive branch, by the Department of Justice, by folks in the FBI. And she talks about the recent case of Jane Harmon, the Democrat, who was heard in wiretaps, basically making some deals with some Israeli agents. Mm-hmm. And that case was pretty explosive a few weeks ago and has suddenly all but disappeared.
Well, I read that it just they just let them go.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't just
let the two guys from AIPAC go.
Yeah.
So she talks, Sibel talks about all of those issues in this editorial titled In Congress We Trust Not. And she discusses how, you know, both of the parties seem to be looking out for each other, and that they may all sort of have enough on each other that, hey, if one starts talking or if they investigate one, then they'll start, opening up on the other guy. So it's a real mess. That we have there.
Face a lot of stonewalling then.
It's a lot of stonewalling and sort of a cozy agreement amongst those in Congress. Well, look, I won't investigate you if you don't investigate me. And that seems to be where we've gotten to, particularly when it comes to, you know, investigation of Congress members. So, you know, it all sort of underscores the power that these lobbies have, that these PACs have, that folks like the American-Turkish Council, ATC, that folks like the AIPAC, which sort of the sister organization to ATC, representing Israel, that these guys have a lot of influence, a lot of money, a lot of power, and the members of Congress are very concerned about that because, hey, they got to run for election in 2 years, and, hey, they're counting on that AIPAC money, that ATC money. And it's a very powerful lobby, and until we get the lobbyists the hell out of D.C., or at least the hell out of campaigns, and replace that with public financing, I suspect this is going to continue for years and years.
What did you think of Obama's exceptions to all his damn lobbyists that are in his administration?
No, the exception of installing them? Well, I'm not sure how many all were installed, but, yeah, you know, I don't like the idea at all. But the fact is, everybody in D.C. is a lobbyist.
Yeah, he's got like five or six guys in his top cabinet that were all lobbyists.
Oh?
Yeah.
I think it stinks. Let's get rid of them.
Yeah, but, I mean, now you're talking about, the great Obama, okay, is suddenly, the king of lobbyists, you know what I mean? Everyone in his cabinet is a lobbyist.
Well, I think that might be going a little too far to say that everyone in his cabinet, but, look, the ties between the lobbies and Congress, it is a revolving door. And, again, Sibel Edmonds speaks to that in her op-ed yesterday at bradblog.com, because she talks about the case of Denny Hastert, who years ago, Sibel had been warning, had, you know, been heard on these tapes. I don't know if it was him personally or folks
who
worked with
him. Yeah, I remember that. I remember him.
Drug money, you know, narco money from Turkish interests in order to avoid votes on Armenian genocide and so forth in Congress. And she had predicted that after he left Congress, he would end up working for the Turks and representing them. And what do you know? 2 weeks ago, Dennis Hastert signed a contract to represent Turkey for $35,000 a month, and he's going to be lobbying Congress on their behalf. Hello?
How handy.
You know, that's what all of these guys seem to do, is that, you know, they make deals, and sort of the quid pro quo is a golden parachute. Hey, after you leave Congress, don't worry, we'll take care of you. And that's certainly what appears to be the case with Denny Hastert. So, you know, the revolving door between public officials and lobbyists is insane. I know they recently changed the law to extend the period of time between, you know, the time you could serve in Congress or in the executive branch before turning around and becoming a lobbyist.
I think it's like 4 years or something now. You know, it was 1 year before.
It was 1 year, now it's 2 years. And frankly, I'm not sure if it works in the other direction. In other words, as you describe, with the lobbyists now working in the Obama administration,
yeah.
I don't know if there's any time limit between becoming a lobbyist and working for the administration, frankly.
There isn't. No, he waived those exceptions. In fact, he tried to, remember the nomination of Daschle. Hey, Daschle was one of the biggest, he was getting paid, what, $2 million a year, all right, as a lobbyist for HMOs.
They all were. I'll tell you, I mean,
criminal.
That's the problem. I mean, if everybody, you know, if every elected official ends up going to work when, as soon as they're done being an elected official, goes to work for a lobbyist, I mean, you know, I don't know what you do, and that's why I go back to the idea of getting the lobbyists' money the hell out of campaigns, out of election, replace that with public financing, so these election officials aren't so beholden to these PACs.
You know, we give what, three? I think this year it was $3. Okay, and on our taxes for public elections, you know, the national elections. Remember, they, you know, on your tax form,
you check off,
you know, your $3. I think it is this year.
Well, that's optional.
Yeah, you don't have to.
But if they would even fund, if they would put what? God. I mean, what's the most important thing in this country? The most important thing in this country is the election process, okay?
Sure.
So if we put $1 billion, or, I don't know, care, $5 billion, okay, into an election fund, okay, that gave everybody, all the runners, equal running money, okay, and then, you know, so much for the
each office
and everything else. I mean, it would be...
And free media time.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of money. And these guys, I mean, these guys are making what? They make $150,000, $160,000 a year as representatives. All right, senators, I don't know. How much does a senator make now? 180 or 200 or something?
Well,
actually, I'm not sure.
Somewhere in there. I know they just gave themselves raises again. All right, and... but
well, look, if you got... You know, whatever that cost, whatever the public finance, the cost it would be to publicly finance federal elections, you know, would be made up in spades immediately,
Absolutely.
Just based on the folks who are out there right now who are, you know, not passing laws or who are passing laws that allow these corporations to save billions and billions of dollars in loopholes and sweetheart deals.
Yeah.
That money would be easily paid for, I suspect, 100 times over. If we went to public financing of elections, no question about it. But again, to get that, to make that happen, you've got to get the folks who are running to do it.
Yeah.
And they don't want to do it because the corporate interests don't want them to do it. And it's really, it's a vicious circle. How you break that vicious circle, I don't know.
Well, it's greed. It's essentially greed. You know, I mean, if they can change that, I mean, all the money they make, every dime that they make. All right. For instance, who was it? Anybody? If they leave office, all that money goes into their pockets. All the money they got left over.
Yep.
All right. From any campaign that they run.
Well, I don't know if it is allowed to go back into their pockets, but they are able to either use it for the next campaign or give it to their colleagues to retire, to help retire their debt.
Well, look at Joe Lieberman, okay? Joe the Mo Lieberman, okay, is being fined $50,000 for misappropriating his campaign funds, all right? And we found out, I mean, we announced this a long time ago, back in 2004 and 2006, okay, that when he's done it consistently throughout his career, all right? But in 2006, he fired, or I think she walked, her campaign manager walked, because he was paying all of his kids, all right?
And who knows how much of his family.
Six-figure salaries, and he wanted a reduction in the staff.
In the staff pay.
staff pay, 20% or something like that. And it was reported in the London Day paper and about this, and it was a big write-up. We read it on the air, and it was. I mean, Lieberman's a schmuck. I mean, he's been defrauding.
But he's only one of many, though.
Hey, look at Chris Dodd, another piece of work up here in Connecticut. I mean, this guy ran around the country, neglected his own job for a year while he ran around, collected $12 million for his campaign coffers, right? Didn't get one vote in the Iowa caucus. All right, dropped out after that. Kept it. Where did his money go? Back into his campaign, right? Or wherever those presidential dollars go, right? And
great deal.
Then all of a sudden we find out that he was the culprit behind the bank frauds and the bailouts and every other fraud.
Freddie Mae and got a great mortgage deal for himself.
Countywide and
yeah.
So it's like this guy. I mean this. All these guys do when they run for president is collect. They're debt collectors. Yeah, that's all they do.
To a certain extent, I understand that they have to do this, because if they don't, their opponents will, and generally whoever gets the most money wins the election.
That's
so, there's really no way to win here, and I'm not trying to give any of these guys a pass, but, they need the money in order to run, in order to win, and until there's a replacement in the system, they're going to keep going back to that same well.
I hate to pick on
any particular one of them in truth, because they all do it, and they all must do it if they wish to get elected at this point.
But they don't really have much incentive to change that system either.
That's right.
Because they are where they are.
And
the system keeps them there.
But let's look at Chris Dodd. That guy had no chance in hell, okay, of getting elected nationally. Okay, he barely had a chance of getting elected in his own state. All right, Lieberman couldn't even make it on the Democratic Party. All right, Lieberman was the most hated man in Connecticut. Right, much less probably the most hated man in the country. All right, so but yet he made $10 million. Okay, $10 million. Okay, in his 206 run. Okay, and it all went in his pockets. And in 204 when he ran for president, you remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What did he do? Okay, all of that money. He dropped out before New Hampshire. All right. I think it's after New Hampshire.
They're supposed to be accounting for all that money. The FEC is supposed to look at at that accounting. The FEC does often bring fines against these guys.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how much goes into their pockets, into their family members' pockets.
They're fining him. The fact that they're fining him $50,000 is one thing, but I mean, the guy probably walked away with $5 million.
Well, right? Before they officially declare that money that gets put up, they can kind of keep. Once they officially declare, then they have to start keeping records. It's a sweet deal, whichever way you look at it.
I know. When are we going to start running?
I don't. I got to get all those lobbyists to like me.
Yeah, I know. You're talking me into it. It's starting to sound better and better all the time. I could use some money.
Yeah, me too.
Especially, it's a sweet deal. You run. What do you? Yeah, not only was he getting paid from his Senate seat, okay, but now they're going out and they're poaching another $10-12 million, all right. And I think what's his face, Dodd raised at least $10 million before he declared.
Well, the real money, as I say, and I really want to recommend Sabella Edmonds' piece at bradblog.com, because the real money comes in the golden parachute. The real money comes after these guys leave office. Mm-hmm. And if you look, I had mentioned Denny Hastert and now getting $35,000 a month from the country of Turkey to represent Turkey's interest in Congress. Well, the firm that he's working for is Dick Gephardt's firm, a Democrat. So,
but does that slob really have any credibility left in it with anybody in Congress?
Who's that?
Dennis Hastert.
Sure he does. He still has friends there.
Yeah, corrupt as they could get. I mean, come on.
Yeah, well, they may be, but, he still has friends there, and that's all that matters. And, he has access. If I was hired to be the lobby for Turkey, who the hell would I talk to? I don't have that kind of access. has the access. Dick Gephardt has the access. So for all that these Democrats and Republicans disagreed, supposedly, while they were in Congress, well, they certainly have no problem agreeing with each other when it comes to cashing in on their many years of public service by taking contracts from foreign entities, and frankly, foreign entities who are known to be spying on this nation, who are stealing nuclear secrets,
right,
selling them to our enemies, like North Korea and Libya and Pakistan, and that's how these guys got the bomb out there, and it all came in Iran. It all came from secrets that they stole from this from the U.S. and, as Sabelle Edmonds has alleged, done at with the help of some of the highest level American officials from both parties.
Well, look at Bill Clinton. I mean, what secrets did he give to the Chinese? You know what I mean? Or what deals did he make with Dubai and with all of these other Arab nations? And now, I wouldn't be surprised if you saw. Well, look at George Bush Sr., the head of the Carlyle Group. What do you think of? You can see George Bush joining the firm pretty soon, can't you? George,
oh, there's no question about it. He'll
prop up somewhere, with a sweet deal somewhere.
Oh, he'll be on boards of directors. He'll make a couple of $100,000 or more per speech. That's what they all do. They all cash in when they do public office.
I remember with Gerald Ford, after he left office, he was making over nine. This was back in the late 70s. Over $900,000 a year just on being on the board of directors of the multiple different companies.
Oh, yeah, and the Bushes and the Clintons make a hell of a lot more than that.
Oh, yeah,
sure.
This was back in the 70s.
Right.
He was making $1 million a year.
Yep.
So that's like, what, $10 million now, probably.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, you have your work cut out for you, Brad.
No, we have our work cut out for us. We are all in this mess together. And you guys, I know, will continue to make noise and to raise hell. I'll do the same. And hopefully your listeners will join us in this effort if they realize, as I've said for many years, this democracy is not going to save itself. It takes the people standing up, making noise. If they want a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, then we, the people, need to continue to raise hell, to make noise, and to demand change in D.C., and I'm confident we're going to do it. How long it's going to take, I can't tell you, but I'm not giving up, and I suspect you guys aren't either.
No, we keep bringing it up, and we think it's really important, and it's great that there are people out there like you with writing letters and galvanizing support for these efforts.
I got to ask you before we leave tonight, I got to ask you what's happening with the Franken and Coleman election.
Well, the election is over. Al Franken has won by 329 votes. Norm Coleman is challenging that in an appeal to the Minnesota State Supreme Court. He's likely to go to the U.S. Supreme Court thereafter, but the fact is he does not have a legal leg to stand on. It was the most open, transparent election recount and then 7-week election contest trial in the history of this nation.
Wow.
Bad news. Norm Coleman lost, and he has either not come to terms with that or, frankly, doesn't give a damn, because as long as they can hold off the Democrats from having the 59th, now the 60th seat since Arlen Specter jumped over, as long as they keep that from happening in Congress, I think the Republicans feel they're taking a victory away. And, in fact, they are, and they're succeeding in robbing the good folks, the voters of Minnesota, from proper representation in the Senate. Right now, Coleman has appealed to the Minnesota Supreme Court. That appeal, Franken had called for the appeal to be expedited. Coleman said, oh, no, take your time, no rush. In fact, the Minnesota Supreme Court has now said they won't hear that case, hear oral arguments in any case, until June 1st.
Wow.
So now we're pushed back to June 1st for the next step. They're filing briefings now, this month, and June 1st. We'll be picking up that ball again. It ain't going to go nowhere. As far as I'm concerned, Coleman has not a legal leg to stand on, but he does have the right to challenge it under Minnesota state law. The real question will come after it's heard by the Minnesota Supreme Court, after they reject his appeal, and they will reject his appeal, I predict. And the question then is, will the Supreme Court order the governor to sign that certification so that Al Gore, so that Al Franken
is
properly seated in the Senate, even if Norm Coleman decides to move forward with an additional appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Even if he does, I would say at that point, the Senate needs to seat Al Franken, and for now, no matter what the federal appeal that Coleman may wish to make.
What's going to happen, or what's happening to Burris right now? They're looking at him right now, isn't he? Are they going to throw him out or what?
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I don't know. There's not a lot that a Senate can do once somebody like that is seated. That's why we have the electoral process. And so I think the Burris will come up for re-election in 2010 because it was a vacant seat. So I think he'll come up again for election in 2010, and maybe the voters who decide rather than anybody else. As far as any investigations go by the Department of Justice, I'm not sure how much Roland Burris is entangled in those investigations at the time or not.
Hey, I wanted to. You've got BradBlock.com,
mm-hmm.
VelvetRevolution.org, and now this.
Press.us.
Yeah, and this one, which is Restore Justice.
justice.com.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
All right, so I wanted to make sure everybody got that.
Thank you. Just to clarify, restorejusticeatjustice.com is a campaign of velvetrevolution.us.
That's correct.
So when you go to restorejusticeatjustice.com, you'll actually end up going to a Velvet Revolution page. And I, Brad Friedman, of the Brad blog at bradblog.com, am a co-founder of velvetrevolution.us. Just wanted to be very clear with all of the disclosures there, unlike folks in Congress, right?
That's all right.
Well, thank you, Brad, for all your efforts, and we appreciate it, as do our listeners, and it's always great hearing from you, and keep up the good work.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. Always great to talk to you. Appreciate it. Keep raising hell out there.
We will. You too.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
That was Brad Friedman talking to us about his efforts to get the Justice Department to do something about people who were politically targeted during the Bush administration. And one of those people being Don Siegelman of Alabama, and another being attorney.
Go to that website.
Attorney Paul Minor.
Restore Justice at Justice.com.
And you can find out a little more about that.
Yeah, I believe there's a petition on that site that you can sign, or there's information. You're going to get plenty of information there. So I want to thank everybody for joining us. Please join us if you haven't had enough of us. Join us if you enjoyed the program on lasteelshow.org every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday night at 8 o'clock. And I'll be happy to take your calls there. Plenty of time to take calls over there, and happy to do that. So, again, we're...
All right. That's the end of that interview. That was from last night's program. I want to thank everybody for joining us. Join us tomorrow night when we dabble into the spiritual world. And on Friday night when we speak with George Dixon. So I want to thank you and have a pleasant evening. Good night.